gonna quit when I'm ahead. Hi, my name is Cliff Roach, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Cliff.
My sobriety date's the 13th of January, 1970. My home group is the Carlsbad AA Workshop, and my sponsor is John Ackerland. And his sponsor is John Haley. I don't know who in the hell his sponsor is. But I just want to know that my sponsor has a sponsor. That's what I want to know. I love to count down. Went backwards, but that's okay. The hell with the newcomers. Let's give juice to the old guys, you know. Yeah, we kind of had Jim and Jim during the day today. The kiddie program is over now. The adults are up here now. I really enjoyed both of them. But whenever we do a countdown, I took this guy to a meeting 12 nights in a row. And in California, probably here too, they always ask for people in their first 30 days of sobriety, raise your hand or stand up or say something. And 12 nights, this guy sat there. So finally, on the 12th night, I turn around and he says, "Why the hell don't you raise your hand?" He said, "I'm not sober." I said, oh, okay. I haven't taken any more meetings either. But I really did enjoy both of Jim. Did a terrific job. And a little later tonight, I might take a dive. But I'm very moved to be here. I'm very struck by the dynamics of the AA here, where, you know, people are really alive and sober, or sober and alive. You know, it just you go so many places, you know, where they just sit around the table and stay sober. Clancy calls them gray tunnel meetings. You know, you have to have hemorrhoids to get the expression just right. And Clancy says, you just trudge down the long gray tunnel. And every year a trapdoor opens and a cake comes down. But, you know, people are alive here and it's really going. And so many young people there respect sponsorship and the traditions. And you don't find that everywhere either. So for old guys like me, it really is a thrill. I really give you a lot of juice. Okay, I'm through kissing up now. We'll get going here. I'm one of those alcoholics that dies of the disease of alcoholism. The experts, whoever the hell they are, I've always said the expert is a guy with a PhD who's still drinking. But the experts say that most of the people that die of alcoholism are like me. 95 to 97%, they say, of the people who die of alcoholism are functioning alcoholics like me. Guys who get up every day and go to work, huh? And do the job. And do it better than you. Who do it better than anybody. You know, a goer and a doer and an achiever. A functioning alcoholic. My buddy at home says a functioning alcoholic is one whose wife works. Don't tell that in an Al-Anon meeting. No. They do not find that amusing. You know, it makes them go. You married guys, you remember that? Don't you think you had a few too many? I used to say you had a few too few. That's your problem, Lydia. Have a couple and loosen up, for God's sakes, you know. Mine was the worst kind, the counter. Oh, they're the worst kind.
That's your fifth one today.
Shut up and eat your breakfast, will you? Leave me the hell alone. Leave me the hell alone. I met my Al-Anon. I love to call her my Al-Anon. You know how they introduce us? Have you met my alcoholic? Sit up, boy. Sit up. Tell them how long you've been sober. I met my Al-Anon in college. She was down on Skid Row looking for an alcoholic to abuse her. And you're looking to be abused. You got your boy here, I'll guarantee you. Oh, the past master of abuse. And we had a dual disease, my Al-Anon and I. We had a dual disease. We had alcoholism and Catholicism. And consequently, we had a kid every 9 months and 20 minutes. And it's what it seemed like to me anyway. You know, every time I come out of a blackout, what the hell is that? They're all right when they're little, you know, like kittens. But we had five of them, and they grew. And the older they got, the weirder they got. And God knows the weirder she got. I was the head nut. And my early drunken logs, pretty much like yours. I didn't steal any golf carts or anything and lead the police on a chase, but I was active. Loved to fight. Fighting was my hobby. I think sometimes I'd rather fight than have sex, which is step two. And it was a shame because I liked it so much because I never won. When I get enough booze, see, to be brave, I would lose my muscle coordination. And boy, you can get seriously damaged doing that. You can get hurt doing that. And I did it over and over. Hardly ever tell this anymore, but one time, four other guys and I went down from Bakersfield, California, to Long Beach, California, to have fun. And I woke up in this flea bag hotel in the morning, and I thought I was blind. I had bled face down on this pillow all night, see, and it dried. So when I come up, the pillow came with me, and I'm in a panic there, you know, I'm smothering. And there was a sink in the corner, and this guy and I threw water on the pillow for about 10 minutes, almost drowned doing that. And it finally went, and there was a big mirror on the dresser. I said, put the pillow back. Oh, my God. I looked like Quasimodo. But the point of the story is I always remember the guys that I was with. They said, you were great, Roach. You got up 19 times. Kind of friends I had my whole life, didn't you? And but I did have a great time drinking. I've always had a great time drinking. Anybody in this place that says they didn't have a good time at some point, better go back and try again. But I had blackouts. Never had a good blackout. I've looked for years for somebody in AA who had good blackouts. Oh, yes, I had delightful blackouts. Thank you. Yeah. There was always blood when I had them and always my blood and wrecked cars in jails. But I met my wife in college. We got married. And I became a school teacher later in life. Guy commits felonies and blackouts, becomes a school teacher. Very good. Very good. Just a hobby. Lighten up. I taught for the first 3 years up in a little town up in the San Joaquin Valley. Called Manteca, which means lard in Spanish. Couldn't even call it La Montequilla, you know, just Manteca. And so I survived that. And we moved to Oceanside, California in 1961. And we had four kids by then and another one, surprising, along the way. And I became a teacher there at Oceanside High. Now, Oceanside is 30 miles north of San Diego, right on the Blue Pacific, was 81 there yesterday when I left. And it'll probably be 80 when I get home tomorrow. if it's not an oxymoron or something, I was a very successful high school teacher. I was good at it. I loved it. Kids loved me. I loved the kids, and I accomplished a lot. Somebody asked my wife one time, why is your husband such a good high school teacher? She said, well, he's a very well-educated adolescent. I hate it when they're accurate and cruel. But, of course, all my life, being Marvin Macho, you know, so many of us suffer from that, you know, I'm going to be a tough guy. Well, I was raised in this Irish Catholic family. Oh, really? Yes. And my father had been the leading contender for the middleweight championship of the world when in his youth. My Uncle Jack used to clean out saloons for a hobby, you know, just the big tough guys. And I had a back problem, big yellow streak down the middle. And, you know, so that macho crap I carried right into Alcoholics Anonymous, well into Alcoholics Anonymous. But since I'm macho and we moved by the ocean, I became a surfer, dude. And I surfed until I was 74 years old. And my back finally said, that's enough. I'd go out and you should see the kids. They love me there. You know, I'd be paddling out. Help Mr. Roach back on his board. There you go. The kids love me. But anyway, I surfed for a lot of years. I was in my 30s when we moved there, but I became a surfer dude. And another teacher and I had a brilliant idea that we were going to open a surf shop there in Oceanside right at the end of the Strand. Guy had this little building that had been a bar, been abandoned, so he just donated us the building, the mayor of the town. He was just sitting on it to get rich, which he did. But anyway, it was all beat up. We're going to open a surf shop there and give surf lessons and rent surfboards and fix surfboards and make a fortune, never have to teach school again. So the building was all beat up, and we had to paint it up and put windows in and fix it up. And we got a refrigerator. A few months later, we got some surfboards, too. No big hurry there. And we had these two chaise lounge chairs. I mean, this place was on the beach, on the sand. And we had these two chaise lounge chairs. And we became sunset connoisseurs. We used to measure sunsets by martinis, you know. I was the mixer. I'd say, looks like about an 8 tonight, Woody. And the best one we ever had was a 15 martini sunset. Oh, you should have seen it. It was glorious. It was glorious. The sun and Woody and I went right together. They found us in the morning with sunburned mouths. Do you remember that? I think that should be on the 20 questions. You ever had a sunburned mouth? Nah, get the hell out of here. You're not ready yet, pal. Come back when you're ready. No. But we did very well. That was in 1964. And we did very well over the summer, but then the winter came and got cold, and we went back to teaching school again. And in February of 1965, I went down to the board one Sunday morning. It was freezing cold morning. And I was going to repair a board, and I had a terrible hangover. Sunday morning, yes. And I was really thirsty. And I went to the refrigerator to see, try to find a Coke or something. And my pal Woody, my partner, had been there the night before. And he left about, this much vodka in a half pint. Just a little dinky amount of vodka. But there was some orange juice in the refrigerator. And I thought, you know, that would put the fire out. I wasn't a morning drinker at that time. I was a weekend drinker, right? Take Wednesday off. Get off my back, I'm a weekend drinker. But anyway, I mixed up that little dinky drink and just drank it down and went on about my business, and I'm sanding on the board there and the resin is cooking, and about 15, 20 minutes went by and that little bit of vodka got in my bloodstream. You know how it'll do? And my mind talked to me. My mind said, shame on you, Cliff. Shame, shame, shame. That was Woody's booze you drank. Why don't you go up to the liquor store and get Woody a pint. That's the kind of guy I am, you know. That afternoon, I got Woody a fifth. And you know what happened. I just ended up a blind, stupid, falling down drunk, and the board was screwed forever. The shop was a mess, and I literally crawled home 11 blocks on my hands and knees and fell into bed and got up the next morning and called Ralph. Remember him? Ralph. I called Ralph for an inordinate amount of time, you know. Right down, it was just me and Ralph. Oh, I hate that part. And I said to my long-suffering pre-Al-Anon, she had one of those pre-Al-Anon ticks in the eye by then. Couldn't let her go downtown. It's a marine town. And I said to my wife, I said, I got to do something about my drinking. I'm getting drunk when I don't even mean to. And I hadn't meant to. And she, the little rascal, had cut this thing out of the paper about the A&A. I don't know why she thought to do that, do you? And if you're new here, it's, as far as I know, the only ad we've ever had. If you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to quit, call Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. I think it's perfect. It sums up how I feel about it, you know. We're not a treatment center, and we're not a hospital, and we're not a 12-step house, and we're not a do-good system. Hell, we're not even nice for people, you know. But I know the people in this room that I know would go to the ends of the earth for you if you're new, if you want to quit drinking. If you don't, have at it, pal. We'll get you next time. That's personally how I feel about it. So anyway, I called the A&A. And in those days, in 1965, there were only 12 meetings in the whole North County at that time. They were all those little gray tunnel meetings, you know, the little six dodos around a table. They had the collective IQ of an orange, it seemed to me. And, you know, I mean, I tried to help them. You know, about the third night, I was laying a little Nietzsche on them. And this guy said, "Hey, we keep it simple here." I said, "No kidding. You could have fooled me, Leroy." I didn't drink for 5 months. I almost caught on fire. I was so dry. But I used to go to a little speaker meeting they would have there in Oceanside on Sunday nights at 6:30. And I would wait for the meeting to start, skulk in the back door, you know, and grab the loser's chair. You know, one where you get one foot outside. And I would sit there in my smugness, my overeducated pomposity, and judge the speakers. Sound like everybody's name was Clem. His wife's name was Martha. And they'd been out of bib overalls about an hour and a half. And I'm in North Dakota, for God's sake. Sorry about that. You know, and you know, they really were kind of retarded people. And they would go on and on and on. I used to sit there in the back and listen. And it sounded to me like they had been rehabilitated. You know the word rehabilitated? That's what it sounded like to me. That at some point in your wretched, miserable lives, you had been okay. I have never been okay. I was nuts when I was 4 years old. And that was a long time before I drank. I've always been crazy. I lived on the edge of psychosis my whole life. And I had heard a speech by Eldridge Cleaver. He was a black militant terrorist who was my hero at the time. Well, that was my politics in 65. Blow it up or burn it down. I didn't really care which. You know what I mean? I was for peace. And if you weren't for peace, I'd kill you. But Eldridge had been in prison most of his life, and he was giving a speech. I went down to hear him, and terrific speaker he was. But that night, he was talking about the prison system, about how they were always trying to rehabilitate him. He said, you know what they'd never known? He had never been rehabilitated. And you can't rehabilitate somebody who's never been rehabilitated. That's how I felt in the A&A. So after 5 months, I resigned from AA. You ever done that? Really upsets them, doesn't it? Cliff who? And I, if there's new people here, I hate this part of the story, but it's the story. You got to tell the whole story. The next 5 years, I was an AA loser. I would come, sit in the back of the room, smirk with that overeducated, pompous ass, smirk, judge you, go back out and get drunk again. I'd come to AA for 30 days, and then I'd drink for 2 years. That's a slip. Then I'd come to AA for 40 days and drink in a year and a half, you know. One time I came in the afternoon at the old club there in Oceanside. These four guys quadro-stepped me. You ever been quadro-stepped? They get it all four sides. You just... Oh, I got the message that day. I levitated out of the building. And I went over to my buddy Big John's house. He was worse than me. Pounded on the door. John came to the door and said, John, we're alcoholics. We have to go to AA. John said, oh, okay. A great big guy led him to the meeting that night and became his sponsor. And the next day, we both got drunk. Just a loser's loser. But I really think I almost died of alcoholism because I was a functioning alcoholic. You know, I never missed a day of work ever. My old man told me if you eat breakfast and go to work, you're not an alcoholic. He never said a word about puking breakfast back up, you know. So I went to work every day. I want to tell you, if you're new, if you think perhaps that an alcoholic's a guy lying on a bench with a bottle of wine in a brown paper bag. The week I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this time, I weighed 163 pounds. I had 4% body fat. I used to surf for like 3 hours and then get out and run 5 miles. I could bench press 285. Took me 25 minutes to pass a mirror. And don't ask me for directions. I say, it's right over there. My daughters used to get money from me all the time. They'd wait till I didn't have a shirt on, which was almost all the time. They'd come up and say, V up, Daddy, V up. And I'd go, they go, oh, can I have $5? Yeah, sure. Yeah. I was 2 years sober before I figured that out. So I was one of the top three debate coaches in the United States. That's an honor roughly equivalent to being one of the top three prostitutes in Elko, Nevada. But among speech coaches, it's a big deal, you know. And I became one of the top speech coaches in the nation by mistake. The principal had called me in a few years before, and he'd gotten a flyer in the mail about this debate and speech tournament. And I was teaching a speech class. So he said, why don't you get some of your kids in your class to go to that? I bet it'd really be good for them, good training. And I was in big trouble, so I said, what a good idea. You know how we are. And I dredged up several misfits to want to go, and we drove down 30 miles down the road to San Diego State College. We were amazed when we got there. There were like 50 schools participating in this thing, like 500 contestants, all the boys in three-piece suits with vests and ties, the girls in these lovely business clothes. We're in Levi's and sweatshirts. What the hell do we know? You know? And they killed us. We did not win a round. I mean, they ground us in the dirt is what they did. I don't know what kind of drunk you are, but it ticks me off to lose. And I went in the coach's room. There were about 20 of them in there. They're old pals. They've been doing this for years. They're buddies. And they snubbed me. It seemed to me. And so I hung around all day. You know how we are. They can snub you longer that way. One guy there really ticked me off. He had a lot of hair. That bothered me right away. Not just a lot of hair, but it was that steel gray, gorgeous, beautiful blue, you know, took 9 barbers to get it right. He had about $1,000 suit on, and the other coaches did this when they went in front of him. 2 in the afternoon, this gray-haired cretin suddenly turns to me and says, where are you from? God, I was grateful to be spoken to. I said, Oceanside. And he said, oh, where's that? 30 miles up the road. Where's that? He gave me a resentment. And I went back to his Oceanside High and I built me a speech team. Took me 3 or 4 years and almost my life, but I built a juggernaut speech team is what I did. I built this powerhouse speech team, and I did it with sheer hatred. 7 in the morning till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, every day, in their faces, screaming, yelling, crouching. The guy next door said, I'd love to watch them leaving your room wiping the spit off their glasses. And this reporter said to my captain one time, what's the secret of your coach's success? The kid said, terror. She wasn't lying. Hey, she's the chairman of the speech department and the chancellor of women's studies at San Francisco State College today. Didn't do her any harm. Bruises on her butt, perhaps. That's about it, you know. Poor old Bobby Knight, they fired him for choking one guy, you know. And it was a guy. Anyway, you know how hard that is? Do you have any idea how much work that is to make 150 people do what they don't want to do? I mean, you got to stay in there all day. I mean, by the end of the day, the nerves are hanging out the end of my fingers that far. My brain's too big for my head. Every muscle in my body's in a knot, and I finished that last kid, maybe 9:30 at night. Good night, Mr. Roach. Yeah, get the hell out of here. But in the glove compartment all day waiting for me. See, I don't drink all day. I don't touch a drink all day. I just have to know it's in the glove compartment when I get through here. The longer I wait, I think, the better it is. And that little half a pint of hot vodka, you know, whatever Thrifty had in the basket that week, remember? Blow the dust off. And it would just lie there in that glove compartment, call to me, go get him, Cliff, baby, I'm waiting, darling. And I'd finish with that last kid, and I'd lurch out to the car, light one of those cheap stogies I smoked in those days, and open up that hot vodka, huh? Oh, I'd love to talk about hot vodka at Al-Anon meetings. They go, eh, eh. But you and I, we know. And I would always drink, I suppose you did too, I always drank half the half pint. Just, oh, and that vodka into the bloodstream, huh? I'd puff on that stogie. I think, damn, you're a good coach. Then I'd finish the rest of that half pint. And I'd sit there in the darkness of that car. And I would have my 8 minutes. And I don't know what your story is. This is my story. After I drink about a half an hour, something happens to me. And I have about 8 minutes where everything in my life is all right. Where you're okay and I'm even better. There's nothing wrong. I am enough for about an 8 minute period. And I was almost willing to die for that 8 minutes. Because in my life, that was the only peace of mind I had ever known. In a 24-hour period, I was assured of the 8 minutes. And that's the only way I could keep going, is if I had... If you'd have stopped me on the street and said, what's serenity? I would have said, it's about 8 minutes, 40 minutes into my drinking. Because that's the only peace of mind I had ever known or was ever to know. And I think it's real significant that all the times I was a loser in and out of AA, I never once told you about the 8 minutes. Not once. So I'd go back out there and it'd get worse, and I'd come back and I'd go out there and it'd get worse. But I built that speech team. No. I almost killed my family doing it, because when I finished with that car in the evening, I drive home and really start drinking. Huh? And I'm a real violent alcoholic and a real foul-mouthed, mean, vicious alcoholic, and I got drunk at home every night. And we had these 5 kids, and I turned that place into an insane asylum. Now, I was raised in an alcoholic family where you got under the bed and hope they didn't find you. Hear the fists hitting the flesh of the wall, bodies hitting the wall. And I would lie there as a little kid under that bed and say, I'll never be like them. And I turned out to be worse than them. And it's late 69, huh? Three of my kids are in high school in late 69. My oldest son is working his way through high school as a hashish salesman. Never had to give him any spending money, I'll guarantee you. Used to hit him up for a fifth about once a week. Yeah, Dad, what do you need? And he had hair down to here, you know. Head went like this all the time. Called his mother, man. Hey, man, what's for dinner? Oh, he was, you should have seen, he was a pip, that guy. He was beautiful. Loved LSD. Probably a few of you understand that. Yeah. And he used to scare the hell out of me. I'd be right in the middle of a sentence. He'd say, what was that? Of course, the shape I'm in, I'd say, I don't know. What was it? Where? What? Yeah. My drunken mother-in-law lived with us, and she would say, I'll explain it. My wife and I got hysterical recently. We were thinking about, we used to listen to the explanation. But anyway, then my daughters had boyfriends that looked exactly like my son. The three of them used to get on the couch together. And it was a zoo. It was an insane asylum. No human power could have relieved my family. But God could and would through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Al-Anon. I was grateful to hear Jim give Al-Anon some juice today. I don't think Al-Anon jokes are funny. Well, a couple of them, yeah. But I have the greatest respect and admiration and love for the program of Al-Anon. It's more responsible, I think, for the salvation of my family, even than AA. But we were all just nuts. And the experts say, same ones, the experts say that for every alcoholism, it destroys 7 lives. And we had 5 kids. So we were right on the median. But as I say, I built that speech team. I'm dying of alcoholism, but I built that speech team. And after a couple of years, my team won one of those tournaments. But I say things to the gray-haired guy, remember him? Wasn't time yet. The next year, there were 12 or 14 tournaments, 30 schools in each tournament. My team scored more sweepstakes points than any of them. We won every single tournament, every single one. But then the third year, there was a tournament. There were 25 schools competing in the tournament. And my team scored more sweepstakes points than the other 24 schools combined. Then I went up to the gray-haired guy. I put my nose right against his and I said, do you know where Oceanside is now? And he just looked blank. He said, what are you talking about? I said, don't you remember about 4 or 5 years ago? You said to me, Oceanside, where's that? And he said, we just moved here from Nebraska. I didn't know where it was. And that's the story of my life. You know, this guy's in his bed every night down in San Diego, you know, and I'm up in Oceanside. I'll get you. And he didn't know it, you know. And so right after that, my wife and I had one of our main events, which the neighbors have come to miss so much. Our neighbors never got television until after I got sober, you know. We've always been the entertainment for the neighborhood, weren't you? Oh, yeah, he's coming back. They all had those Venetian blind marks on their forehead, you know, from watching out the window. But that night we had a pip, boy, and we really went at it. And I said, maybe I ought to just move the hell out. Everybody said, yay, go for it, Dad. And so I did. I moved out. I moved down at the beach with a buddy of mine and his girlfriend and with my surfboard. I had said for years, but I just unload that witch and those long-haired dope fiend children, I'd be okay. And I got rid of them, that wasn't it. I was drunk all the time. I was missing work, which had always been my badge of courage. And I went by the house one afternoon to harangue my wife about money. And the hashish salesman was kind of bobbing in the background there. Humming a tune from the planet Pluto. And as I look back at it, it's probably the stupidest thing I ever did in my life. I turned to him and I said, "Dave, what's it like not to have your old man around the house?" And my son, my 16-year-old son, looked me straight in the eye and he said, "It's beautiful." And he was more afraid of me than anyone, you know, with good reason. He had more reason to be physically afraid of me. But the courage that little 16-year-old guy, I probably would not be here tonight if it wasn't for the bravery of that 16-year-old kid. He looked me right in the eye and said, "It's beautiful." And I went back to that dump on the beach and sniveled and whined and screamed and hollered and cursed. But I did not take a drink that afternoon. And I went out and sat on the screen porch and watched what's still today the most beautiful sunset that I ever saw. And about the time that the sun was going down into the water, I had what our big book calls the moment of clarity. I saw me. I saw what my son saw. Polly, my friend out on the coast, she calls it the moment of grace. I love that. Grace. The gift. It's all a gift. It's all just a gift. But I went in the bedroom and dug out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I had read in my travels through the program. And being an English teacher, I thought it was very poorly written. I had read a lot better this time. I read the big book, Are You New Tonight? I read the big book for 3 days and three nights. I called in sick. I didn't go to work. I ate a little bit. I slept even less. And I read the big book for 3 days and three nights. I read all the stories. I read the appendix in the back. And in the second edition, there was a story called The Professor and the Paradox. And he was another egotistical school teacher. And he saved my life. And he's in the new book, Experience, Strength, and Hope. All the old stories that were in the big book are in that, and it's in there. The Professor and the Paradox. And on the third time through the book, on the 13th of January, 1970, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was on page 63 again. And on page 63, if you're new, there's a little prayer. And the prayer is step 3. I've always called it the formal terms of surrender. And I knelt down on that filthy linoleum floor in that dump on the beach where I was living, and I read that prayer out loud to myself. Lord God, offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And both the speakers spoke earlier and me today nailed it. I've heard 200 fist steps in my ears in the program, and the number one defect of character of every man I've ever worked with is self-obsession. Relieve me of the bondage of self. I looked up the word bondage when I was new. It means slavery. And something happened to me on my knees that morning on the 13th of January, 1970. My life has never been the same again. For 32 years, I tried to tell you what happened to me, and I never could. And then 2 years ago, in the grapevine, this little girl, she's 22 now. She was 17 when she did this. She was in a treatment center, and she did exactly what I'd done 33 years before. She knelt down and read that prayer out loud to herself on her knees. And in the Grapevine article, she said, "I was engulfed by a great laughing love." That'll do it for me. I was engulfed by a great laughing love. And I knew exactly what I had to do. That night I had one over this little guy, Bill Blake's house. Little electrician there in Oceanside, had been a skid row wino, had 8 years sobriety. You know, one of those nauseating AA fanatics that you just hate when you're a loser. You know, you barely get in the door and they leap on you, you know. "Hi there," yellow teeth pointing at you. He used to always come up and put his arm around and say, "Would you like to go to a meeting in Los Angeles with us tomorrow night?" "No." for you Cretans around here, why would I drive 100 miles to meet some Moria, you know? But I would just say, no, thank you. You know, I didn't like him. Isn't it funny? I was at his house that night, knocking on the door. Five-year loser. Just an obnoxious, overeducated, pompous jerk. Loser. In and out all those times. Margie, Bill's wife, opened the door, and here I am. Huh? Are you new tonight? I have never seen anyone so glad to see me in my life. This loser. She saw me, Margie, lit up like a Christmas tree. Oh, Cliff. Oh, come in. In the house I go. Pours me a cup of coffee. She said, oh, this is wonderful. This is great. Bill's been crazy lately. He's had nobody to work with. Oh, this is so nice. Then Bill comes in. Ah, Cliff! About a half an hour, I'm thinking, anything else I can do to help you folks out? Be glad to help any way I can. And maybe feel like Cliff's here, we can start AA now, you know. But 3 weeks later, I was in a newcomer meeting, and one of the other newcomers said, what do you mean this is a selfish program? And when the guy asked the question, I knew the answer. I got the answer the night I got here. They were tickled for me. They'd been praying for me for 5 years. But they were more glad for Bill and Margie. Because Bill and Margie knew the great secret. You can't have it unless you give it away. You cannot stay here unless you give it away. And how you give it away is your business. Everybody has their own. My sponsor had this theory that everybody who comes to AA, alcoholism, we can take care of that. Everybody who comes to AA has their own particular brand of insanity. We can fix that too. He used to say, we got a wrench that'll fit every nut. But he also believed that everybody who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous has a gift or gifts of some kind. And if you don't bring your gifts, then you have to go back out there and die. You know, in that funny, silly, goofy show you did earlier, that's people bringing their gifts. Negligible gifts, but their gifts never... I'm just joking. But don't leave your day jobs. Oh, they turned the mic off on me. That'll work. They trust a guy with 18 months on the goddamn mic. Well, I wouldn't let him in my backyard alone, you know. And so I love to watch people bring their gifts. I love to watch people. A guy in my group, Carlos, if you're new, he finds you. He has an antenna of some kind. And he pounces on you, and he finds you if you're new. And then people who make great coffee. And my sponsor was the worst speaker in the history of AA, Bill was. He was terrible. He used to say, I've talked everywhere at AA once. But you put my sponsor in the front seat of a car with a newcomer. He was magic. No one ever escaped him. No one ever escaped him. And when he died, we had a meeting for him. There were like 700 people came for this little electrician. And I led the meeting. I said, how many of you here loved Bill? 700 hands shot the air. How many of you had a resentment against Bill? 700. He never had a resentment. He was a carrier. Oh, he was something. Thank God. He was the meanest man that ever lived. Thank God. The nicest thing he said to me the first 5 years was, shut up. Shut up. I told him, I have degrees, you know. He says, so does a thermometer. You know where they stick that sometimes, don't they? I thought the first step was, shut up and get the car. You know, he had a colorful adjective just before car. Just shut up and get in the car. Nobody wants to hear what you have to say. You don't know nothing, you moron. If you knew anything, you wouldn't be in my back seat. Now shut up and get in the back. In the middle on the hump. There's a method to that, too. I mean, if you're the one on the hump in the middle, you become a 12-stepper. You find a new guy. Hey, come with us. And now I'm on the window. All right. You know. You want to talk about love? The man took me to a meeting every night for 2 years. He took me to a meeting every night for 2 years. First it was just me, then Al came, and then Skip, and then Bernie, and then Bob, and then Don, and then the other Al. We had so many Al's we had to give them names, like the other Al, the real Al. The other Al was not crazy about anything. Pretty soon we had 3 carloads of guys, you know. And we went everywhere in Southern California. We didn't go to a meeting, you know, in a town one night. We went to meetings all over hell. We went to L.A. all the time. His sponsor was Clancy, so we had to go up there every Tuesday night and to hear the laughter, huh? He took me to meetings like this, like you people. He took me to meetings where people were laughing because he knew me. I couldn't stay here. I'm sorry. If there were only Gray Tunnel meetings, I'd be drunk out there. I'd be dead. I'm sorry. I can't live without the laughter. Oh, I love the laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the laughter is the spiritual part of the program. There are 3 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous worldwide, which is like 1 jillionth time any treatment center or any other program of solving alcoholism has ever touched. We're so far ahead of anything that ever touched, and we're the only ones that laugh. That's the secret. You know, and if you're new and you don't feel like laughing at yourself, we'll do it for you. Yeah. Bill would always help me out with that. And then you, yeah. Shut up and get in the back. Oh, I love the laughter. I like to get me a new guy, you know, take him to a meeting and take him to another meeting and take him to another meeting. Maybe the 12th or 13th or 14th meeting, I'm sitting beside him and he goes, gotcha! I gotcha now! Because once we got you laughing, you belong, see? So if you're new here tonight and you've been laughing, you're screwed. Because you know you belong here now, see what I mean? There's 2 of them that haven't laughed yet, so I'm watching them. But they're going to protect themselves. I wouldn't have laughed either when I was there, you know? Nothing I laugh at will ever come back and haunt me again. The stuff I used to lie awake all night, my teeth grinding and my stomach turning. It's funny now. And if I get a new guy and get him to laugh at himself, he's almost home free. Oh, the laughter. I love getting brand new Al-Anons. My wife's meaner than me. We get brand new Al-Anons. We take the speaker meetings, AA speaker meetings like this, you know. Get her in between us, you know, so she can't escape. And the guy's up here at the podium. I fell on the Christmas tree and smashed all the presents. And we all go, ah! This new little Al-Anon sitting there. Not funny to her. So we just take her to another meeting tomorrow night. And one night she throws her head back and laughs. And hey, or Al-Anon, I don't care where. When you laugh here, then you know you belong. And you're on the path to starting to get well. And I had lots of troubles when I was new, terrible troubles. I owed $1 billion, you know. Didn't have a brass razoo. And she wouldn't go to Al-Anon, had a foul mouth, had all these long-haired, dope-fiend children flopping around the house. So I would go to my sponsor's house and just sob. You know, I had a nervous breakdown. He'd open the door, and I just let it go. You know what they're doing over there now? You know, and I'd go through the whole, sobbing through the whole story, and he'd always listen, never interrupted me, just stand there. I found it's good to make a noise once in a while when you're up there. Oh. Hmm. That way they think you're paying attention, you know. And I'd just run down. I'd just be out of all the things that were happening to me in my life. And he would say, go get Al and take him to the meeting. What the hell has that got to do with a nervous breath? But if you're new, remember that morning on the 13th of January 1970, I gave it all up. I gave up having answers of my own. I turned it in. So I did what the man told. Al had no driver's license, of course. And he was a 10-year loser. I was only a 5-year loser. And he was a big blowhard. I hated him. I'd drive Al to the meeting. Blah, 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 blah. We'd set the meeting up, make the coffee. Everybody come. Everybody go home. We'd set the meeting down, put the chairs away, wash the coffee pots. We had real cups. He had to wash because he was so shaky. He just put his hands in the water. But I could dry. When you're new, you got to feel better than somebody. So I'd load the blowhard in the car and drive him home. Blah, 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 blah. And I'd let Al off, see? And I'd start driving home. And this feeling would come over me. It would start right here. And it would just go out all through my butt. Oh, it felt so, it was terrifying. It felt so good. Better than the 8 minutes ever was. Only lasted 40 seconds, you know. I thought it's because I got rid of Al, you know. But then I stood at the door like these wonderful people have done all weekend and shake hands when you're coming in. I had to do that, which I didn't like because I'm a snob. You know. Hi, what's your name? Like I really, you know. And mop floors. And then, of course, most important, I went on all these 12-step calls. We used to get a lot of 12-step calls in those days. And I got to see the light come on in men's eyes. I got to see them get sober and stay here. And little by little, that feeling grew and stayed longer and longer and longer. And when I was about a year and a half sober, I figured out what the feeling is. It's a feeling of being enough. And I don't know about you, I've never been enough of anything in my life. But the actions I've taken in Alcoholics Anonymous have made it possible for me to be enough almost all the time. And we did the program. Which one is the program? The steps. We did the program. If you're new, all this is fellowship. And it's wonderful. That's the program. As my sponsor said, since you're a brilliant intellectual, we numbered them for you. 1, 2. That's the process of recovery, the 12 steps. That's the program. And the program's worked for me, and it has worked for my Al-Anon wife beautifully. And it has worked for my Al-Anon daughter beautifully. The steps will change anybody if they're ready to change. It's a process. They'll work if you don't believe in them. They'll work if you think they're stupid. You know, they'll work if you think they're simplistic nonsense. If you do them, they'll work. My sponsor believes in doing them. There's action involved there. Don't meditate on them or take courses on them, you know, or put lint in your navel and pretend like it's the steps. God, why don't people, just a simple bunch of directions. I always think of the old joke where this young priest has been in the back of the church and the old priest is in the sacristy doing some stuff. And the young priest comes running. He says, Father, you'll never guess what happened. He said a young man came in the back of the church. He was on two crutches. And he took some holy water and he threw it on the right side. And he threw away the crutch. And he took some holy water and threw it on the left side. And he threw away the crutch. And the old Monsignor says, it's a miracle. Where's the young man? He said, flatten his ass out by the holy water. No tapes required at all. Just do them. And my life started to change. And so I've been pretty much now for going on 36 years doing exactly what I just told you what I did. I've been being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Every day of my life I try to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when it's not convenient. Especially when it's not convenient. I'm not one of these people when the phone rings at 1 in the morning. I'm just not one that leaps out of bed and says, oh, the 12-step call, hot dogs, you know. Are you? I get up and say, what the hell? Nobody left notes inside but me, for Christ's sake. Hello? Because all my relatives are dead. I know what it is, you know. Oh, sure, I'll be right there. I don't have to like it. I just have to do it, that's all. And when I was my first 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in what we call service. Jim was talking about being a GSR. And,
and that kind of thing. I was a GSR and a DCM. I did the whole alphabet, you know. And I was area treasurer in the area, vice chairman in the area, chairman, and the delegate on panel 26, which was a long time ago. And so I served 2 years at the conference. And my buddies did other things. They were busy in AA as I was, but they used to kid me. They used to say, "Ah, here comes the politician. What do you do that politics all the time for?" And I used to say to my buddies all those years ago, I used to say, "I do this because I want AA to be here for my kids if they need it. And I want it to be AA. I don't want it to be some watered-down, psychologized nonsense. I want it to be the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that the little electrician brought to me." And my youngest son now has 18 years of sobriety, Chris. And my middle daughter, Jan, had 12 years of sobriety and got a bad back and started taking pills. And I have no opinion on pills. I'm just like Scott. They'll cut you off in the sunlight of spirit and kill your ass dead. But I have no opinion on them at all. And she drank again, of course. And now she has 5 years again, and she's just doing beautiful. She's a teacher, too. She sits right behind me in my home group, so I don't miss anything. And she's just a beautiful, wonderful person. The hashish salesman, he's one of the foremost experts in the world on the growing of coffee. And he was an agriculture major. For many years, we didn't want to ask anybody who was growing. None of my business. But he has 5 years of sobriety. And he lives in the state of Washington, but he travels all over the world. He speaks Spanish fluently, so he goes to meetings in South America, Central America, Mexico. And this week, he's in Zambia, Africa. And that's his second favorite meeting. His home group's in White Salmon, Washington. But his second home group is in Zambia, Africa. It's in the Canadian consulate there, and there's like four Canadians and four or five Americans, a couple of native guys that speak English. He just loves that meeting. And he teaches people in the third world countries how to crossbreed coffee so that they get a better crop and they don't have to be third world countries anymore. And he's got 5 years. And so all my kids that need Alcoholics Anonymous, and AA was here for my kids, just like it was when I got here. It was AA. It had not been watered down. Both David and Jan are GSRs now. And when I heard that, I cried so much I had to take salt tablets. The fact that they see it. Because we had a couple of the grandkids. We're keeping the door open for them. And as I said before, my daughter Kitty, a lot of times I say she went wrong. She's been an Al-Anon about 20 years. She just can't drink. What a weenie. She says, "I'm the only family in the world where if you don't drink, you're in trouble." She said, "When I drink, I get sick." My youngest son said, "You can get through that." But I want to tell you, if you could be at my house when we all get together, you could not believe it. They're all middle-aged people now. But everybody in that family loves everybody else in that family for fun and for free. And we have the best damn time. And the laughter, you just can't believe the laughter that we have together. That's from a family that was totally insane. So, if you're new tonight, you don't have to believe that all the wonderful, great things that have happened in my life and in my family's life is going to happen to you. You don't have to believe that at all. I didn't believe it was going to happen to me. I believed it happened to Bill. And that kept me in the front seat of that car for a year. I believed it happened to Bill. But you do have to believe something tonight. You have to believe that it happened to me. That an insane, angry, vicious man lives almost every day just like the book promised me I would. Happy and joyous and free. And that's how I live. And I hope you do too.